Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything
except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW 91.7, San Francisco's oldest, most innovative public radio station.
We're continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
And we take them from the Stanford campus to the air, and from the air, we take them to the internet via our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org. Neither John nor I has weighed in yet on this topic, but we will after the show, so go check it out.
And the topic is the ethics of identity. We need to explain two things, I guess. Identity and what ethics has to do with identity and identity has to do with ethics. What do we mean when we talk about a person's identity?
Well, there's lots of things we could mean. Here's one of the things I have in mind anyway. Let's see if you have the same thing in mind. That's how I represent myself to myself, what I take myself to be. I am an American because I was born in America, but more importantly, I take myself to be an American. And the significance of that is that when I take myself to be an American, I live as an American. I march under the banner of I am an American, or I am an African American, or I am a man.
So that's one meaning. We've got the way you represent yourself to yourself and what you consider most important about yourself and which attributes of yourself more or less shape the way you live your life. But there's at least one other notion of identity, and that's how the world sees you. Sometimes this has been called the me as opposed to what you're talking about, which is the I. And then there's a third thing, really. When you introduce yourself to someone, they says, well, who are you? You kind of have to negotiate between your own identity, how you represent yourself to yourself, which you may not want to exactly disclose to everyone.
Yeah.
And how the world sees you, which you may not exactly agree with. So you'll give them some kind of third thing, how you project yourself to the world.
Oh, that's certainly true. I mean, it's certainly true that there can be a mismatch between what you take yourself to be and what others take you to be. I mean, if I'm a slave and somebody takes me to be chattel, I can refuse that designation. I mean, I may in fact be a slave, but I may not be willingly live as a slave. You know, they may have to overcome me in some way, and my resistance is, you know, representing myself as free and autonomous, despite your wanting to take me as a slave.
The world may think of me as a pointy-headed, over-intellectual philosophy professor good for nothing, but I don't have to accept that. I can think I'm a pointy-headed, over-intellectual philosopher that's occasionally good for something.
Here's another question, really. I mean, can I just take myself to be whatever? I mean, I might not take myself to be a black man, and the world takes me to be a black man. Well, it seems to me there's something wrong with that. If the world takes me to be a black man, and if I have a certain history, well, then I am a black man, even if I don't take myself to be one.
Well, you'd have a little trouble passing for white, but a lot of black people do pass for white. Do they become white? Does that become part of their identity, or is it just false consciousness?
Yeah, those are good questions, and we'll have to explore them in some greater depth with our guest, Anthony Appiah. But to help us start thinking about identity and what people take their identities to be, our roving philosophical reporter, Amy Standen, went out and talked to some people about their identities. She files this report.
Who are you? If the people I interviewed were filling out a census form, they might give one of the following five answers. An African American, a Muslim, a Jew, an Irish American, a model train enthusiast.
I would say that I'm a traveler. That's who I am. I'm a traveler in search of some clarity. Who I am in terms of my embodiment, the casing, the presence, the physical appearance that I present to people is not me. It's not the essence of what constitutes what I call myself. So I don't like to address myself as an African American. Esoterically, I'm not. I'm an entity. But in terms of sociological identity, you know, sometimes I go into that category because it's more, you know, it's expeditious.
Who am I? I am female. I am Jewish. I am young. I feel that Judaism is such a part of me and is such a part of the way that I think and the way that I do things that if people are going to understand where I'm coming from, they need to understand the Jewish aspect of my life. It is important to me that people know that I'm Jewish.
I'm not sure exactly how to answer the question other than just, I'm a model railroad enthusiast. It means that you're very interested in creating miniature worlds in which trains seem to be the dominant feature. It does perhaps take a higher priority than other people might put on it. It is my main interest.
I am a proud Chicago Irish American girl from the city. Proud being the first one, yes. I am a very confident 30-something-year-old woman. I said Chicago. I'm very proud to be from Chicago. And Irish-American, yes. And I said Irish-American versus American-Irish, I suppose, because that's exactly what I am. From the day I was born, we're surrounded by anything Irish culture. My parents speak Gaelic at home. I live and breathe it. I live and breathe it. A lot of the Irish people I know are vocal, confident.
I have a range of identities, American, Muslim, Marylander, all that. One day it's one, the next day it's another, so I would rather just classify myself as a human being and then take it from there. Being a Muslim, my identity is important to me. It's one of among many identities I have, but it's probably up there in the top one or two, three slots. There are political and there are other reasons to not only set myself apart, but let people know that within their midst, there are Muslims. I'm one of them, and I'm proud of it.
For Philosophy Talk, this is Amy Standen.
I'm John Perry. With me is Ken Taylor. Amy's piece was very interesting, Ken. If we ask a person, who are you, they react in a variety of ways, but there's some commonalities. Geography is often important. Religion is often important. Ethnicity is often important. But most interesting, in a way, was the model railroad.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
That was the passion. What all these things have in common is, and remember, this is the identity that they're putting out to the world, is what they think is essential for other people to understand them, what makes them tick. And he realizes that, you know, a passion for model railroading might not strike you as being all that normal, but if you're going to understand me, you got to understand the priority it has in my life.
Yeah, and to help us think about this stuff more, this is deep, hard, important stuff. We're joined by Professor Anthony Appiah, who's a professor of philosophy at Princeton University. He's a very prolific writer, author of many, many things. His most recent book is The Ethics of Identity. Anthony, welcome once again to Philosophy Talk.
Hi, nice to be here.
Anthony, great to have you back on Philosophy Talk. I've been reading your new book, The Ethics of Identity. And you make a number of distinctions. You distinguish between individuality, life plans, and identity. Why don't you tell us, in the course of writing this book, how you came to define or see this central concept of identity?
Well, actually, I don't think I have to do very much on that topic, since it seems to me that you guys, in your original discussion, mentioned all the things that seem to me most important. That is, the fact that it has to do with how I think of myself, the fact that it has to do with how people treat me, and the fact that we have to negotiate between how we think of ourselves and how other people think of us. All that seems to me central to social identities, and that's basically what you need to understand to begin to think about why they matter.
Well, one of the surprising things in your book is your use of this character from The Remains of the Day. Most people probably haven't read the novel, but I'm sure a lot of them saw the movie, and we have a butler there, somebody who you wouldn't think was going to be grist for a philosopher's mill, the kind of authentic human individual that we all aspire to. But you make it out in a fascinating way, and you distinguish between his sense of identity between having to do with his plan for life and what determines how he lives his life. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Right. I think the useful notion there is this idea that you already mentioned of individuality. I mean, what I'm talking about and why identity matters for ethics is how we make our lives. And the thought I had was, look, in making our lives, one of the things that we make use of are these social identities. I make my life as a man.
I should mention Mr. Stevens, for those of you who haven't ever read the book or don't remember the movie, is a butler, and he defines himself as the butler of a certain important man, and the man's importance turns out to be rather important to the butler's feelings about himself.
Right.
But butlers aren't the usual philosopher choices for exemplars of lives well lived.
Well, Mr. Stevens' life, I want to concede at the start that part of the point of the novel is that Mr. Stevens' life is in a certain sense a failure. What I wanted to focus on was what he was trying to do. He was trying to make a life of significance, and his being a butler was for him an important element in making his life. He did things, including not marrying a certain woman, including not turning up at his father's dying bedside, because he felt he had duties as a butler that were so important that he had to abstain from these other areas of normal human life. Now, I think he made a mistake in that, but what I was interested in is the fact that this fascinating character in this novel, beautifully played by Anthony Hopkins in the movie, does have a sense of where his life is going, and in making sense of that life, he uses the idea that he's a butler, he's the butler of Darlington House, he's Lord Darlington's butler, to explain to himself and to define for himself what he's up to. And the fact that Lord Darlington is in fact basically an idiot, an upper-class idiot who doesn't understand what he's doing, who's being manipulated by the Nazi ambassador to London in the period leading up to the Second World War, is something that damages Stevens's chance for living the life he meant to live, because he meant to be the butler of a great man.
Anthony, I want to focus a little bit on part of the sort of underlying tone of voice with which you talk about this stuff. You talk about making a life, and I guess making an identity, or maybe choosing an identity. I am an African American man. I didn't choose that. And it's in some sense not really up to me. I mean, maybe there's something that's up to me, but some fundamental fact, I'm a man, that's not up to me, right? I mean, life and choosing, help me understand, how free are we to choose a life or make an identity? Isn't it, to some extent, something just kind of handed down to us?
I think that in making a life, we have to both respond to the identities that we have and which we don't have any choice about, but also make two decisions. One, can I reshape this identity in a way that makes more sense to me? What it means to be an African-American has changed in the last 30 years, in part because both collectively and individually, African-Americans have reshaped an African-American identity, and so that it's possible to be, as it were, an African-American in ways that weren't possible 30 years ago or 100 years ago. So that's one element of choice. The other element of choice we have, of course, is whether we will allow this element of our identity to figure largely in our planning of our life. And someone can say, look, I'm a black person, I'm an American black person, but that doesn't figure much in my thinking about my life. It figures a lot in other people's thinking about my life, so I have to take account of it. But when I'm thinking about my life, when I'm unconstrained or less constrained by what other people are thinking, in those circumstances, I think about other things. I think about my model trains. I think about my life with wife.
Do you have model trains, Anthony?
No, and I couldn't think of anything less like me than being a model train enthusiast. I was trying hard to be sympathetic.
Anthony, I'm going to ask you to hold your thought for a second. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our subject today is the ethics of identity. Our guest is Anthony Appiah of Princeton University.
Are our identities given to us by birth and biology, or are they a hoax perpetrated by society and cultures to keep us in our place? Or are they something of our own invention that makes our life rich and more fascinating than it would be otherwise? Would we be better off to throw off all of our notions of culture and group identity and just treat each other as individuals? Let us know.
How do you define yourself? We'll take your calls in a moment. Philosophy Talk will be right back.
Say it loud. James Brown with Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud. I'm John Perry. I'm not black and I'm rather modest. I'm here with Ken Taylor.
We're discussing the ethics of identity. Tell me about your identity. Where do you think it came from? Did you freely choose that identity? Is it just a cultural inheritance over which you have no say? Join us. The number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
Outside the Bay Area, call toll-free at 1-800-525-9917. Call us and tell us who you are and how you know who you are. You can also email us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
Our guest is Anthony Appiah, author of The Ethics of Identity. Anthony, some people I know wear their identities, let's say, lightly. I mean, they regard whether they're an African-American or not as a matter of not much moment. Some people wear their identities really heavily, right? And it matters a lot to them that they are identified as this or that, and it shapes their lives. Tell me how to think about that. Should we wear it? Is there any norm that we can say? Should we wear identities lightly? Should we wear them heavily? I mean, which identities are worth wearing lightly? Can you help me think about that?
I think that there's a wide range of reasonable responses to what you take to be your identity. I think that you have to accept that certain things are given by your social circumstances, by your biology, by history, and then you have to work with them to do this thing that I call making a life. Now, when somebody asks me how seriously they should take a particular dimension of their identity, I think a lot depends on what the history is of that particular thing. Take an example. Some people now in this country think of themselves as witches, and they take it pretty seriously. Other people think of themselves as witches, and they have a kind of what you might call ironical relationship to this. And most of us think that there aren't any witches at all. So we don't know how to treat someone who says that she's a witch. Here's a case where this is one of the cases that you asked the question earlier, is it invented, is it given? This is one of the cases where I think it's, you know, way out at the invented end of things. But even at the invented end of things, people can do something with an identity, and whether they can make it work for them depends a lot on their imagination and their circumstances. So I don't think you can answer for somebody else without knowing a great deal about their lives whether it makes sense for them to take, say, their racial identity very seriously or to bear it lightly. I think we should allow people a good deal of flexibility in that. Well, but I will say one thing. Go ahead.
It can't be just anything goes, because it seems to me, here's an intuition that I have. It seems to me all right for a black guy. Maybe I'm wrong about this, but it seems to me all right for a black guy to say, I stand in solidarity with other black people and I work for the advancement of black people. It seems to me all right because we think of black people in many societies as oppressed, as disadvantaged in certain ways. It seems to me not all right in the same way, at least, for a privileged white guy to say, I stand for the advancement of other white guys. I mean, there's some asymmetry.
Yes.
And there's got to
yes.
be something about kind of, you know, the role, the sort of real historical role that identity has played in our shared lives or something that
yes.
explains that.
Well, I think the key thing is that an identity can be criticized, and the mobilization of an identity in a life can be criticized if it's being mobilized for injustice. And it can be commended if it's being mobilized for justice. That's one dimension of assessment of identity. So in this country, there's something called the Christian Identity Movement, which is a bunch of people who think it's fine to kill Jews and blacks and homosexuals. I don't think it's just fine for people to identify with that identification. I think it's important for them to be shown both that what they want to do in the name of their identity is immoral, and that they're diminishing their chances of leading a life of significance for themselves by wasting their time with this immoral project.
Is this how the Christian identity people describe themselves, that they think it's all right to kill these people, or is this a slightly...
Biased.
Is it a biased view? I think the answer is that some of them have said that they think this, and others of them have denied it. But my point is that hostility, anyway, racial hostility up to the level of violence against Jews and blacks and homosexuals is sort of part of Christian of one core element of the Christian identity movement. Now,
But also violence towards Christians and Jews is part of being a Muslim, in the sense that some Muslims do this, but we wouldn't want to say that. It's, well, that the Muslim movement is just one that says
John,
it's okay to kill Christians
and
Jews.
John and Anthony, there's a kind of background question I want to address a little bit, though. Because something you said, Anthony, made me think, it's interesting that you think that how we mobilize our identity should be constrained by some sort of prior considerations of justice or morality or something like that. Some people think that our identities themselves directly generate obligations, right? It's because I'm an American that I'm obligated in certain ways to fellow Americans and not to people around the world, right? And I just wonder how you think about that. Can identities just, the fact that I'm a black guy, the fact that I'm American, just on its own directly generate a set of obligations, commitments, entitlements?
I think that some can. I'm not sure that racial identities can, but I think that, for example, an identity as a parent, as the person who's either biologically or socially responsible for the upbringing of children, for example, or as a child, that is, as having someone who's socially or biologically responsible for your existence, I think there are responsibilities generated by that. I mean, the question you're really pushing towards is the question, can the demands made by our identities conflict with the demands made on us by morality? And I think the answer to that question is yes. I think these are both genuine sources of value and obligation, and that sometimes they pull in different directions.
Now, what do you mean by the obligations of our identities? Do you mean what people who co-identify with us think we ought to do? Or do you mean just having a general bias towards our co-identifies of the sort we might have to our kith and kin? How can an identity make a demand on us?
Let me give you an example that isn't like either of those. A professional identity, right? An identity or a vocational identity can give you certain obligations of self-development. If you think of yourself as and are living a life as a novelist, there are certain things you ought to be doing, like writing novels. And writing good ones.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. This is John Perry. I'm here with Ken Taylor. Our guest is Anthony Appiah, and we're discussing the ethics of identity. I've got a question here from email. It's very interesting. It says, since the globe is shrinking and more couples from different ethnicities, religions, and races are having children, what effect does this mixing have on contemporary notions of identity? Does it add to the myriad notions of identity, or does it reduce the definitions into an eventual homogeneous singular definition? Anthony, you're a product of one of the great romantic mixed marriages of the 20th century, so you're a good man to give us an answer to this question.
I think that being from having sort of parents from whose identities are from different groups that are famously distinct, as it were, just gives you a range of options that other people don't have.
In your case, it's the British aristocracy and the African nobility, or have I got that wrong?
That's roughly right. I'm related to the King of Ashanti, and my great grandfather was a law lord in England.
You're an immigrant to America. So
An American citizen, and happy to be so.
Yeah, right. So you're a man of multiple
yes,
identities.
Yes, and I should say.
You teach at Princeton, which is surely one of the unique privileges of human beings.
Yes, yes. Now I have the privileges I started out with have been added to.
Some callers lining up to join our discussion. Paul in San Francisco, welcome to Philosophy Talk, Paul.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. And I have a question. You kind of touched on it earlier, but I'll just put it again. It seems to me that the phrase ethics of identity is perhaps a bit of a misnomer because it seems like perhaps something, a more appropriate phrase might be something like the ethics of essence, because it seems that at some level it's the view that moral agents and moral patients have a certain essence that persists over time through any accidental changes they might go through. And when stated in this way, the issue becomes, to me at least, more problematic, because it seems that in our society at least there's a tradition of skepticism around the idea that we have certain essential attributes that define the scope of right moral action. And even if you accept the idea that, well, okay, we can choose certain things which then define our identity, it seems that even in that case you're saying that, well, these things in terms of which you define your identity have certain essential features that persist over time.
Thanks, Paul. Anthony, what do you think? Are we being committed to some kind of essentialism here?
First of all, by ethics, I mean the study of the question what it is to live a good life. So morality, that is the matter of how we treat each other, is only a small part of it. It's an important part, a crucial part, but it isn't the only part of it. So I think it's a mistake to think of our identities, as it were, just shaping how we should treat other people. Crucially, our identities shape what projects we should be engaged in ourselves.
So you think that a person's having an identity, having not quite a life plan, but a sense of who they are that guides a lot of their decisions and so forth, is on the whole a good thing. It seems to me that there's two elements of choice there. I can choose among the various properties I have to think what's important to me. But also, I can just choose properties I don't have. I mean, at my age, it was in fact a very incompetent football player, but I could pass myself off as having been somewhat of an athlete. I was in fact raised in Lincoln, Nebraska, which is just a big suburbia without a city next to it. But it's a little more romantic if you're from Nebraska to kind of pretend that you're from a farm. Is it okay in forming your identity to just lie to yourself and others about it?
No, and that's because it's wrong to lie. and in other words, that's a good example of the way in which morality constrains what we can do.
Yeah, but it's only a contingent fact I didn't have a more interesting upbringing or wasn't more competent at athletics. Why should I be bound by these old, tired facts?
But it is a fact, John. Join our discussion.
But it's a fact.
By calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Outside the Bay Area, you can call 1-800-525-9917. And we have Steve in San Francisco on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Steve.
Well, thank you very much. Good afternoon. My question was, and maybe statement, is I have been a computer programmer for 35 years, and I see that I built into that my identity as a person, respect that I thought I should have, and also the American male need to be the breadwinner and accept that identity. And in my case, with the outsourcing and the dot-com bust, I've been out of work. So for me, I need to reform my identity, and I never realized how important it was innately that when I walk up to a person, I accepted that role. And I believe that society accepted that role. So now, as just a person, I need to reform that. And
Steve, that's very interesting and a little affirming for me. We tell our philosophy majors and our students that take philosophy courses that the advantage of the humanities in general and philosophies in particular is it gives you a broader sense of who you are. And you may specialize in some part of engineering or science, but in the long run, just in terms of your professional identity, you'll be better if you have a more flexible and grounded conception of who you are. So maybe we're not just giving them bull. Maybe we're saying something that's sort of true.
Thanks, Steve. Anthony, do you have any guidance? Do you have any guidance for people how to think about what kind of identity is an appropriate identity around which to configure your life? I mean, does philosophy have any guidance?
I don't know. I think it's a good moment to say what kind of role I think philosophy can and can't have in this. I don't think I can answer the question how anybody should live their life. What I hope I can do is give them some of the tools for thinking about that question, some of the concepts that are relevant, and I do think that identity, individuality, and this notion of making a life, for example, are useful. Now, I think that it's a mistake in the modern world to tie your identity too tightly to a career. That's just a view I have. It's not a view that's it's not a view that I would say I have philosophical arguments for, but it is a view that I have. And so when people get themselves too bound up with their career and their profession, I think it's important to urge them to think about, as it were, widening the scope of how they think about themselves and the role of other aspects of who they are in shaping how they plan their life. You know, somebody rightly once said that hardly anybody on their deathbed says they wish they spent more time at the office.
Yeah.
And I think that that's right.
I take your point, Anthony. I take your point. I mean, a career seems too particular, too local. But, you know, I think of myself as a cosmopolitan kind of guy. And people sometimes criticize. I think of myself as a citizen of the world, as advocating the party of humanity and not any particular more specific party. People say about us cosmopolitans that we have no roots. We have no attachment to a particular country, to particular kin, because we see all humans as on a par. So, I mean, what do you think about that? Is that a just criticism? Are these particular attachments, are they morally important?
I think the particular attachments are morally important, but I don't think that it's inconsistent with that to think that we should belong to the party of humanity. I think that if you look at the history of cosmopolitanism, especially the modern history starting in the Enlightenment, it's perfectly clear that in fact, cosmopolitanism and nationalism as philosophical ideas developed together. They developed at the same time. So it just seems to be a mistake to suppose that thinking that it matters what happens to everybody on the planet and that we should be concerned about that entails that we shouldn't also be specially concerned about our family, our neighborhood, and our country.
So, Anthony, you say that even as a philosopher, you don't really want to recommend to people what their identity should be, but surely you must have some negative advice. I would think, for example, we mentioned earlier Christian identity, and people who identify so strongly with a religion or ethnicity or any kind of abstract ideal that part of their identity is to dislike or hate or think the world would be better off without other people. Surely, as philosophers, we can say that's a really bad idea, not only for the society at large, but for your own growth as a human being.
Correct. I think that's crucial to understand that certain forms of identity have immorality, for example, injustice built into them, and that makes them criticizable on those grounds. You may be able to reform an identity that currently has an element of chauvinism in it in such a way as to liberate it from its chauvinist elements. And the reform of identities is something that we engage in all the time. We have been engaged in the reform of gender throughout my lifetime. The situation of women in relation to men has changed enormously since I was a child, both in this country and in every other country in the world. Not enough, I think, in many countries, but still, changes have gone on. And those changes, those reforms, have shaped what the options are for men and for women in new ways. They've made it easier to be a male.
We're discussing identity with Princeton University's Anthony Appiah.
How should society and government deal with issues of identity? Should government recognize ethnicity, race, religion, and the like? Or should it be blind to these issues? We'll get to more calls. Sarah's up after the break. And emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
Eddie Brickell and the New Bohemians with What I Am. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. That was Edie Brickell, John. And I'm Ken Taylor. We're discussing the ethics of identity with Anthony Appiah of Princeton University. Give us a call, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
And outside the Bay Area, you can call toll-free, 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Or email us, comments@philosophytalk.org.
Sarah in San Francisco has been waiting for a while. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Sarah.
Thank you.
Go ahead. Tell us your question or comment.
Okay, so I find it really difficult to answer the question, who are you? Because everything that comes to my mind as an answer to that question is immediately self-contradicted. For instance, I would describe myself as an animal lover. I have a dog. I'm a dog walker. I love animals. But I have flypaper in my kitchen, and I'm not vegetarian. So how does one even describe their identity or construct an identity when there's so many immediate self-contradictions?
Good question, Sarah. Anthony, you got an answer for Sarah?
Well,
thank you, Sarah.
There's a famous answer to that question from a famous figure in the history of one identity, namely St. Paul, who said, the good I would, I do not, and that I would not, that I do. We're constantly doing things that are inconsistent with our own best thoughts about who we are and what we should be doing. I don't happen to think there's anything wrong with having the flypaper, by the way. But I do think there's something wrong with not worrying about the way in which, for example, pigs are treated in factory farming, well, not factory farming, but in the regular farming of pigs. So I think somebody who genuinely cares about the welfare of animals ought to worry about the latter thing as well. But as I say, you know, you can think of yourself as justly as a Christian, but recognize that you sin all the time, even though part of being a Christian is about aiming not to sin all the time.
Your remark about St. Paul reminds me of St. Augustine, who, when he was had decided to become a Christian, his heart had moved, had my favorite prayer. He said, Lord, give me chastity, but not yet.
But not yet.
That's kind of the way I feel about vegetarianism. Yeah,
yes.
I think I'm convinced that I ought to be at least a lot closer to it than I am. But let's stave off that self-improvement for another couple of good dinners.
But there's a deep question here, you guys. I think we need to focus on it just briefly. Look, my identity, our claiming an identity, the claims we make for our identities play lots of purposes. They're not, and sometimes they're for show. I mean, I don't mean that. I mean, we claim an identity with a purpose in the world to get others to respond to us in a certain way. Mm-hmm. We claim a victimhood. We claim, you know, we claim privilege of a certain sort. We do all this claiming is in this political stew of us pressing back and forth. And sometimes it's just, it's not really like living a life, but just getting stuff for ourselves, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
I mean, sometimes we can reflect and it can be sincere and deep, but sometimes it's just a mess.
Yes. And I think that there is a danger in a certain kind of identity politics, if you like, in which we flaunt particular identities in order to achieve certain effects without a deep commitment to thinking through what it would mean to take those identities seriously. And also, just in order to make claims that are, in fact, false or at best misleading. People do that all the time. They, when somebody says, you know, I'm a Christian in a certain context, that may be an attempt to get people to think of them as a better person than they are. And they may at some level know that that's what they're doing. So this happens all the time. But I mean, you know, that just goes back to the point I said earlier about you know, it's wrong to lie. It's wrong to deceive people. And identities get involved in lies and deceit. That is true. That isn't an argument against identity. It's just an argument in favor of using them properly.
Well, it can be pretty complicated. I mean, people can treat me in a certain way because they are stereotyping me. But then maybe if it's to my advantage, I'll just slide along and let him do it. We have an interesting email from David via Yahoo. He says, my wife and I are of European and Mexican descent, respectively, but neither of us identify as such. We are often thought of as white and Hispanic, whatever that means, by others, to the extent that such thoughts motivate action. Our reception from others may be and has been ethically wanting. Then a nice turn of phrase. Identity is not unlike pride. It is dangerous.
Well, you noticed that in your initial sampling of opinions, people mentioned pride in their identity quite a lot. And I think that when you ask people what their identities are, of course they're going to mention the ones that they're proud of, because that's what you do when you're, as it were, showing off. You mention the things you're proud of. But I'd like to point out that identities are just as often a source of embarrassment and shame. You can be embarrassed or shamed by the actions of your country, for example, in international affairs. Because you identify. You can't be ashamed of America unless you identify as an American.
Right, definitely. You know, I want to ask you one last kind of question. It shifts the topic a little bit. I think of myself as a kind of squishy liberal guy. That means, in one way, that I don't think identity should be taken seriously, because basically we're all human beings, right? The party of humanity. So that entails you should wear your identity lightly. Maybe the government shouldn't force an identity on you, but and it should kind of be neutral about different identities. You know, you can have this identity, but you can't kind of force your identity into the public square as the determiner of how we should live. What's your view? How should the government regard all these different identities? You know, should it just say, yeah, it's up to you, you know, have whatever identity you want?
I think it needs to worry about two things. I think it needs to worry about discrimination on the basis of these social identities, and I think it needs to worry about making sure that if certain social identities require certain resources, in order that the people who have the identity should be able to live meaningful lives, they should make those resources, help to make those resources available. So those are the two ways in which...
The last thing you said, think about religious identities. What should the government do with respect to making resources for the formation of religious identities?
For example, the Canadian government helps minority groups that come in with unfamiliar religions, gives them the resources in which to helps them with the resources to create community centers and so on, where they can continue to teach and practice their religions. Now, and it does that in the name of respecting the need of people to be able to make their lives, make their own choices in their lives about what identities will matter to them.
Now, in France, though, they have a rather different idea. There was this big issue about headscarves, and that often mm-hmm. came out making the French sound awfully intolerant. But the basic idea, as I understand it, is that children should be spared the necessity to live an identity controlled or inherited by their parents when they're in the public domain, which sounds like a different strategy, but an honorable strategy for dealing with the complexities of identity.
It's an honorable strategy as long as you understand that it entails that those many religious claims are false. The state regularly, of course, takes sides, because it has to, on the question of whether religious claims are true. But if you stop a Muslim girl wearing hijab or something smaller than that in a public school, what you're doing is denying the claim that it's Quranically required for women to display chastity in public. And if you deny that claim, you're denying a religious claim. And you can't say that you're doing that in the name of neutrality.
Yeah, Anthony, you know, unfortunately, we've just begun to scratch the surface. We're now getting to some deep stuff, but we've run out of time. And so I'm going to thank you for joining us.
It was a great pleasure. Thanks very much.
Our guest has been Anthony Appia of Princeton University, prolific writer and thinker, author of most recently The Ethics of Identity.
And we want to thank not just Anthony, but all the callers who didn't get a chance to talk to.
So, John, what did we learn today?
Well, today, and in reading Anthony's book, I learned that some distinctions between different kinds of identity. I learned a new appreciation for John Stuart Mill. We didn't really talk about him with Anthony, but in addition to Anthony's book, The Ethics of Identity, John Stuart Mill's autobiography would be a very good thing for listeners out there to read if these topics have piqued their interest. And then in talking the conversation today, I learned it's kind of complicated. I mean, there's so many different ingredients that go into the identity of a person. And it seems to me philosophers ought to be able to say something about what belongs and what doesn't belong and the considerations people ought to take. And, you know, it was shocking to hear a guy talk about himself as a model railroader. But the more I thought about it, it's a pretty harmless identity. It's not based on hating people. It's not based on promoting some people at the expense of others. It's a pretty good identity. Let's all be model railroaders.
Yeah, but it seems like it's not the kind of thing you can really build a whole life around. But you know what, John? This conversation, have you seen the movie Crash? This conversation reminds me a lot of that movie Crash.
I have seen the movie Crash, a movie about identity and the problems it raises, particularly in Los Angeles.
So why don't we take philosophy talk to the movies? The storyline is really complicated, and you could not summarize it in any short order because there are all these intersecting stories, all these different narrative arcs, all these different people crashing into each other. In the first line of the movie, Don Cheadle says, "We've lost the sense of touch. We all just crash into each other, right, to make contact." And then there are the series of car crashes that get the whole thing going.
Don Cheadle does another amazing job after Hotel Rwanda. The guy is turning into a huge star of serious films.
Let's talk about what the movie's about. It's about ethnic and racial identities and the role they play in people seeing one another and perceiving one another, or really failing to see and perceive one another.
Well, or I would say situationally seeing one another at one time and not at another. I mean, the guy that seems like the heavy, the Los Angeles Police Department officer who's very racially insensitive and
that's the
cruel
Matt Dillon
and
character.
Crude, yeah. So he stops a biracial woman with a black man, and he's obviously offended by the situation, maybe because he took her to be white. He gropes her during the arrest. He's just tremendously offensive, and you hate him. And then a little later, he does something quite heroic where he is relating to a non-white person as a person and risks his life to save her.
Yeah, it's very complicated because there is conversion and there is redemption, but it's all there. It's all in the mix. Tragedy, redemption, conversion. But a lot of it is like completely, utterly accidental. And it takes somebody dying for somebody else to turn the corner. It takes somebody almost killing somebody. Right? There's a scene in which an Iranian man who has a store, but his lock is broken. He calls a locksmith. The locksmith is a Latin American who comes to his store and fixes the lock, but the door needs fixing, and so he doesn't fix the door. The store gets robbed. The Iranian man goes to the guy's house and tries to kill him, except his gun has blanks in it, and the guy doesn't end up killing him.
Just by luck.
He would have killed him, except for what philosophers call moral luck.
And that
little bit of moral luck is his moment of redemption. He's redeemed through this act of trying to murder in cold blood another man and by luck not doing it.
Moral luck is the idea that your intentions and your actions and the sense of bodily movements can be the same, but in two different situations, those intentions and movements might result in you doing something truly evil and despicable, where in another situation, it's just a near miss, nothing, no harm done.
But look, what's the philosophical point of this movie? I mean, in one way, it's a critique of kind of the role that racial and ethnic identifications play in us, the way that they blind us to our common humanity. It's complicated, though, because we see the humanity of some, right? So this Matt Dillon character, the cop, the utterly racist pig cop, he sees the humanity of his father. He cares deeply about his father. That actually moves you, the extent to which he cares for his elderly, sick father and the steps he's willing to take. But he doesn't see the humanity of this couple that he stops. But through this other incident that happens that I won't give away, he comes to see their humanity, but only accidentally. He's full of resentment. But how does he throw that resentment off? Not through, you know, his own efforts or something, but because of an utter accident, a situation into which he's thrown, which kind of forces him to throw off these identifications. So we were talking with Appiah about how some people wear these identities lightly. This is a story of how when you wear your identities heavily, the world can cause all kinds of tragedies for you, but give you a moment of redemption in which you lighten up.
Well, I think you also mentioned another major theme, which is moral luck. And the extent to which the difference between our moral luck and our moral lack of luck shapes our lives and determines who we are and what we deserve is a very deep and intriguing philosophical theme that comes out in this movie in a very powerful way.
I think in a way there's no simple reconciliation that this movie, Crash, offers us. Because, you know, in the end, it just starts again. There's another crash. There's another ethnic confrontation, and the moment in which one character sees another character's common humanity despite the ethnic divides that separate them. They're accidental. They're through moral luck, not through their own efforts. I mean, and so the movie says some people lose out, some people gain. Our common humanity, we keep bumping into each other, sometimes seeing it, many times not seeing it. And when we see it, it's utterly accidental that we see it. And what prevents us from seeing it is identifications, racial, ethnic identification, and wearing them too heavily.
You know, I'd like to mention the movie was directed and written by Paul Haggis, and he's the same guy who wrote Million Dollar Baby. So there's a real talent that's probably going to be producing philosophically rich films for us to discuss for quite some time.
And the name of the movie is Crash. It's philosophically rich, very complicated, very pertinent to our discussion of the ethics of identity.
Ken, it's fun talking about movies, but it's also fun to help our listeners talk about the philosophical problems that arise in our own life.
Yeah, if you've got a conundrum, you can send us an email at conundrums@philosophytalk.org. We won't promise to solve your problem, but we will give you lots of new ways to think about it.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University.
Our executive producer is Gordon Earle.
Special thanks to Dave Fusaro, Nicole Sawaya, Ben Temption, and Alan Farley.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Pacific Division of the American Philosophical Association and from various groups at Stanford University.
And even more support from the Friends of Philosophy Talk and from the members of KALW Information Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our funders.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Thank you.